Danke. Ja, Damen und Herren, Senoren und Senorita, Ladies and Gentlemen, Honorable Members, you are welcome. Let me also officially open this meeting, which is a joint meeting of the Standing Committee Finance, Standing Committee Appropriations, Select Committee Appropriations, and Select Committee Finance. Welcome the chairpersons, Honorable Buthelezi, Honorable Masango, and Honorable Karim. You are welcome. And welcome members from the National Assembly, NCOP. Let me also acknowledge the presence of chairpersons of portfolio committees and standing committees dealing with finance from provinces. We are welcome colleagues from provinces. Welcome officials from Parliament and Treasury if they are present. Apologies. I only have one apology of Honorable A. Lewis, who will be late. Okay. Honorable Dipuo Peters is late, will join us. Those are the two apologies, Honorable Matao.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. There's also from the Select Committee on Appropriation an apology from Honorable Mkiva, who is attending another meeting. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Matango. Those are the apologies. Let's right away move to item three, presentation by the Parliamentary Budget Office. I'm not sure who's going to do the presentation. Okay. You are welcome. Let's right away go into the presentation by the PBO, then later we'll take questions for clarity and comments. You are welcome.
Good morning, Chair, and thank you very much. Good morning, members. I will start the presentation. I'm Nida Orlandi. I'm heading the policy unit in the PBO, and my colleagues will also introduce them when they do their sections of the presentation. Just something to note, we might change the sequence of some of the slides because one of our colleagues' grandmother died this morning, and he was supposed to present. Okay, better. Okay. So just in terms of our presentation is based on the content of the MTPPS. So we will start with the policy priorities that has been given by the President at the beginning of the year. Then we'll do an overview of the global economy as well as the domestic economy and also provide you with an outlook of the economic situation. And then we will summarize the first 5 months of revenue and expenditure and show you the current status of the public finances. We will also update you on the status of the provincial expenditure. Just in terms of an introduction, the MTPPS provides an update on government's finances and the economy, and the status of the current situation in terms of spending and revenue. It does not, at this stage, introduce new taxes. It will also show some changes to the fiscal framework and the fiscal situation. Specifically, it will allocate spending and budgets for unforeseen and emergency situations that has occurred during the first 5 months of the financial year. We will also see some new prioritization within the budget, and the detail of all this you will see in the adjusted estimates and the adjusted appropriation. The Minister might also use this opportunity to introduce the new government growth strategy, as well as provide us with more information on the National Health Insurance Bill that has been tabled in Parliament. And the MTPBS also proposes allocations to departments, provinces and local government, updated. Updated information on provinces and local government. So what are the role, or what is the role of the committees in this MTPBS process? The Finance Committee will mainly focus on the fiscal framework, the revised fiscal framework for the current year, as well as the proposed changes over the medium term. They will also look at the assumptions underpinning the fiscal framework. The Appropriations Committees will more focus on the spending, the current spending, and reprioritization over the medium term, and changes to the division of revenue. They will also look at the adjustments made in terms of the conditional grants to local government and provinces. And then, obviously, actual spending, and how actual spending informs the new budgets going forward, as well as the adjustments, how the adjustments, budgets or votes inform the new medium-term budget policy, expenditure framework. In terms of the status of the National Development Plan, I just thought we would update you on where we are. So the President already acknowledged in June in the SONA that the 2014-15 MTs did not nearly enough make progress in the first 5 years on the target set for the NDP. This means that government must prioritize and focus on implementation of this plan. The PBO's research findings on the contributing factors to the slow progress include mechanisms adopted for the implementation of the NDP. We also found that the design of the 2014-2019 MTSF was not conducive for implementation. The integration of the NDP activities into standard processes of government, we found that the indicators and targets were not really included into APPs of the relevant votes that are responsible for the outcomes of the NDP. We also found that the alignment of the planning and budgeting structures had an influence on the implementation of the targets, and the reporting, monitoring and evaluation of the NDP was not proper. Even the last year of the first five-year period of the implementation, no progress were reported in terms of the program of action. So we only got progress on the first 4 years of the medium-term strategic framework. So we tried to do a comparison in terms of the strategic direction for the policy priorities as well as for budget allocations. So the President indicated that economic transformation and job creation was one of his main priorities. In the State of the Nation address, education and health will always be priorities. The consolidation of the social wage through reliable and quality basic services, spatial integration, human settlements and local government has been identified as a priority, social cohesion and safe communities, as well as a capable, ethical and developmental state, and a better Africa and a better world. The President also indicated some of the goals, which makes some of these priorities more measurable, and you will see the first one is the economy must grow much faster than population. Schools, 2 million more young people must be employed. Schools must have better educational outcomes, and every 10-year-old must be able to read for meaning. And one of the other goals are no person in South Africa should go hungry, and the last one is violent crime must be halved. these targets have been set, or goals, which are measurable for the next 10 years. You can also see we try to compare all of these, the targets and the priorities, with the National Development Plan, and there's a good correlation between the strategic direction that the President has provided. In terms of the 2019 budget that was tabled in February, there was also allocations made, provisional allocations made. So during the course of the financial year, since April, some of these allocations had been made, and we've also see it in some of the next slides. Over the medium term, $23 billion per year was set aside for the reconfiguration of ESCOM. We have seen that some of that money has been transferred to ESCOM, and additional funds have been allocated to ESCOM for the current financial year as well as the next financial year. In some cases, allocations were conditional on finalizing policies or building capacity. The three that we can mention that we've seen received transfers already or required for additional funding was SAA, DANEL, and the SABC. And there was also money provisionally appropriated for or allocated for the SA Connect Phase 2 and the implementation model to roll broadband out to public buildings, to establish townships and a rural enterprise fund that provided for money for road maintenance, to fund a 1 monthly ATM withdrawal for each social grant, and also the Competition Commission to investigate cartels and anti-competitive behavior. These things were already indicated in the budget review of 2019. So in the adjustments budget, we will see whether some of these allocations has been made. The PPO also did a summary of the National Health Insurance Bill that has been tabled. And just in terms of to show you whether there will be or what the financial implications will be for this current year, we also looked at the financial implications section of the bill that has been tabled. The summary can also be provided or distributed to members to read if they are interested, because it's really a summary of a summary that we made just to try and make it clear on what the bill is actually all about. So in terms of the funding, the bill indicates that there will no be no additional funding required for the next budget for 2020, but there are amounts of $75 million already available over the MTF that they will reprioritize to the fund if funds are required. The human resource capacitation grant will be used to appoint staff to ensure implementation of the fund, and already increases in the current budget has been made since 2018-19. It already increased from $330 million to $601.11 billion over the medium term. Other costing that has been done, but the National Treasury did this, not based on any technical structure or framework, but just in terms of experience, they indicated that they might need about $30 billion per year when we want to implement national health insurance or a national health system to improve the services of the public sector. My colleague will continue with the global economy section.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. Good morning, chairs of committees. My name is Siraj Mohammed. I'm the head of the economics section within the PBO. I'll be taking you through the slides on the global economy, macroeconomic overview, and fiscal policy. Just in terms of the global economy, the macroeconomic outlook has worsened, and we see that major international agencies like the UN and the IMF have revised on global growth since their last estimates last year. With the IMF, they actually made an estimate in earlier this year, and they revised it down to 3%. The United Nations World Economic and Social program, a document from the UNDESA revised it down to even further, 2.9% in 2.7% in 2019. The reasons given across these different institutions and within the literature and the media that we see is that one is there's an agreement that the global economy is now demand constrained. There's slowing industrial production. There's weakened international trade activity, and we all know about the Trump tariffs and the problems between China and the U.S. especially, but also we see other problems around the world related to that. Lower commodity prices and lower fixed investment levels globally. One way in which countries have tried to deal with this was the reintroduction of monetary stimulus, and in the EU we see that they've renewed quantitative easing, basically increasing liquidity into the financial system. And in the US, there's lowering of interest rates, and basically people are also referring to what the US is doing now as the equivalent of quantitative easing. But there's recognition from the central bankers themselves, from economists around the world, that interest rates are at an all-time low and that monetary policy is recognized to be insufficient. In fact, we're seeing that a large amount of bonds for developed countries, private and public sector bonds, are now negative interest rate yields. and that basically means that if you're paying somebody to lend money to them, right? We're also seeing that the lower yields are influencing what's happening to borrowing costs, sovereign and private, within emerging markets. So the major global consensus looming is that there should be an integrated fiscal and monetary policy approach. There's a recognition that monetary policy alone, especially in a very low interest rate environment, is inadequate. And there's an agreement that countries facing an economic downturn should use expansionary fiscal policy. The IMF is adding a right to this and saying that certain developing countries, especially those with high debt, shouldn't be using expansionary fiscal policy as much, or they should be more careful about it. But in other agencies and other views around the world, which I'll get to later, there's a view that expansionary fiscal policy should be used more generally in this current environment. And I'll get into the reasons, as I said. This graph shows the economic performance and outlook for the world, emerging markets and developing markets, sub-Saharan Africa and South Africa. And we see, if you look at, so the period from 2019 onwards, the dotted lines are estimates. If you look at from 2017, there's been a downturn everywhere except for sub-Saharan Africa. If you look at South Africa, the thicker green line at the bottom, our economic growth has actually been lower than the averages for the world, for emerging markets, and for sub-Saharan Africa, and that we're not performing as well. But we, as with other countries, there are estimates that things may improve in the future, but as we've seen, there have been year on year, there have been revisions by everybody, including National Treasury, of growth estimates downwards. So I think we need to take that with a pinch of salt. Now, the global macroeconomic situation is linked to fiscal policies around the world, and so to some extent, this decrease in performance is linked to fiscal policy. Now, weak aggregate demand is the key cause of poor global economic performance in an integrated world. There's been widespread global adoption of fiscal consolidation and austerity that has had a synchronous cumulative effect in lowering global demand. So basically what this is saying is that, you know, if you cut your spending, it's not going to affect everybody in the world that much. But if a large amount of countries around the world cut their spending together, it's going to have a huge cumulative effect. And in fact, that effect, what we've seen since the crisis, but especially since 2017, is leading to a serious global demand problem. So fiscal consolidation has therefore been an important contributor to poor economic performance, not only in individual countries, but globally. The ILO in 2015 said that
118 countries had contracted expenditure relative to GDP. They say overall austerity has become a new normal, with the majority of countries in the world contracting public expenditures in the period 2010 to 2024. However, the global experience is that fiscal consolidation has not led to lower debt-to-GDP ratios because it contributes to lower GDP. So this isn't only South Africa's experience, it's a global experience of countries that have tried consolidation. And in cases where consolidation has been led to serious cuts in government expenditures, it's led to austerity. So there's a continuum from consolidation to austerity. And what I end the slide with a quote from the 2017 MTBPS, where the Treasury said, over the past 4 years, government has followed a path of measured fiscal consolidation, aiming to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio by reducing spending and introducing tax increases. But debt has continued to rise as a share of GDP as economic growth rates have declined. Now, this table, which I suppose it would be hard for you guys to read on the screen, but you do have a printout in front of you. So what this shows, let me just go to my notes, it would be easier for me to read it from my notes, is that the most important measures associated with fiscal consolidation is what it shows. It shows that there was widespread adoption of these measures globally in countries that implemented fiscal consolidation. So the second column basically gives you the numbers, and I won't really talk to the second column that much. I'll talk to the third and fourth columns. So the form in which fiscal consolidation, and I basically went through a lot of literature and took out the main ones. These aren't the only ones, but these are the main ones, and also these are the kinds that we see being promoted by organizations like the International Monetary Fund. First is adjustments to the public sector wage bill, and these have led to reduced real salaries, job freezes, and retrenchments, and the envisaged negative social impact was poorer delivery of basic service and development. And the ILO makes a comment in their literature that the majority of workers affected in different countries that have adjusted the public sector wage bill were teachers, nurses, police, etc. Labor flexibilization has been another measure that has gone with fiscal consolidation. It was billed as a labor market reform to make hiring and firing easier and to reduce wages and benefits. The negative social impact was that more work became precarious and informal and lower paying. Revising consumption-based taxes such as VAT, it occurred through the tax system being made more regressive and not considering more progressive taxes. The impact was that prices of basics like food and other basics increased and the welfare of the poor declined. And this is again from an IMF study of the impact of fiscal consolidation around the world. Targeting of social assistance or safety nets, it occurs often through changing the criteria and for eligibility and so reducing the number of people eligible for these benefits. The negative impact was a reduction in social protection. And the last one I have got on the list of a much longer list is the privatization and strengthening of PPPs, public-private partnerships. It occurred through reducing the role of the state in the provision of services and infrastructure. The negative impact was proliferation of private monopolies and unaffordable and low-quality goods and services, and also high costs of guaranteed revenues to PPPs in places like water, electricity, etc. And it's important to note that if we look at the point in the final column as well, that all of these have served to decrease demand in countries that adopted these measures. Now, these measures have been adopted in developed and developing countries. The ILO studies have been focused, that I refer to, focus mainly on developing countries, but also look at developed countries. Now, as I said, there are different views on fiscal consolidation. The one type of perspective can be, I think, characterized as what's coming out of the IMF. And basically what I did to show this perspective is to look at the latest World Economic Outlook of the IMF, October 2019, this month, it came out earlier, and what they advocate for South Africa in terms of fiscal consolidation. So what the IMF is saying in this most recent World Economic Outlook is that they encourage developed countries to actually move to fiscal expansion, to borrow more, to spend more, to basically spend their way out of, to some extent, out of the low growth problem that we've been seeing since the global financial crisis, and that has become moved downwards again from 2017. But they are saying that developing countries that have higher interest rates and higher may have higher debt levels should still continue with fiscal consolidation. And in South Africa, they say this should happen through reducing the public wage bill, downsizing and eliminating wasteful spending by public entities, expanding the tax base, and strengthening tax administration. Now, these are necessary things you can argue with. It's about degree and how much. I mean, we do want to eliminate wasteful spending. We do want to strengthen tax administration and expand the tax base. The issue is how we do it and who is affected by it. The IMF also suggests structural reforms, including revamping the business models of state-owned enterprises, improving competition in product market by reducing entry barriers and streamlining regulations, and also increasing labor market flexibility. So these are, I think, fairly familiar, and we've heard them before in South Africa, including in the latest document released by National Treasury. Now, the point I make at the last point is that the IMF assumes that fiscal consolidation and sectoral reforms will improve private sector confidence and stimulate investment. Now, that, I think, is a really important thing, and the next view on fiscal consolidation I come to comes from organizations within the United Nations, such as the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, who also in October released, a new trade and development report that covers some of these kinds of issues, and also the International Labour Organization. Now, their views support fiscal expansion and a greater role for the state in supporting economic recovery and growth. And the reason why they argue is this is that they recognize the negative changes in the global economy that have been linked to the outsized and destabilizing role of financial institutions and unregulated financial flows, and basically drawing on the experience of the global financial crisis. Now, in their latest report, the UNCTAD talks about hyper-globalization and the impact that has had. Now, what this has caused is that an increased allocation of finance away from long-term fixed investments towards the pursuit of short-term high returns in financial markets. And so they argue that governments in this situation have an unrealistic expectation of the private sector in this context. Within this context, especially in the period since the global financial crisis and the slow recovery, where you actually still have a very large role played by global financial markets and pressure by the shareholder value movement for large corporations to increase short-term returns rather than make long-term public investments in things that may have a public or social good, it's very hard for the state to actually turn and say, we don't have money to do this, the private sector needs to do this. There needs to be a partnership, but you can't expect the private sector to carry most of the weight. That the UN agencies are arguing is an unrealistic expectation of the private sector in this context. They advocate fiscal expansion for investment in infrastructure. They argue for industrial policy and other sectoral initiatives, as with the IMF and the Treasury paper. They argue for the green transition, and we've seen more and more discussion of this, and basically using this as a way to spur growth, but also to deal with the looming problems that are going to cost us billions in the future with global warming and other environmental problems. And then services to uplift people, so basically putting money into the poorest parts of the population to spur aggregate demand growth and so increase GDP and tax revenue. And in this way, reduce the debt-to-GDP ratio. They also talk about crowding in productive private fixed investment and employment in this environment where we've seen less private sector investment, not only in South Africa, but globally. They argue for an investment in health, education, and other improvements to uplift the lives and the productivity of the poorest of the people, and reduce the long-term costs associated with unemployment, the erosion of the social fabric, and environmental damage. So this is an alternative view. The next two slides are going to look at what fiscal consolidation is and the logic behind it. Since it's a policy that we've followed for the last 6 years, It's something worth interrogating, and it's also, I think, a central discussion within how we develop, think about our fiscal policy and the fiscal policy framework. Now, the economic idea behind fiscal consolidation is contractionary expansion. Now, this is an oxymoron, right? If you're contracting something, how do you get expansion? So the idea is that if government cuts its spending and contracts, they reduce their levels of debt, they create confidence in the market, and the private sector then becomes more confident and likes what government's doing, and then they'll put more money into the economy through investment and job creation and expansion. Now, I'm going to go through some of the logic of contractual expansion. The first step is that government's fiscal balance, which is either surplus or deficit, right, in the budget, over time determines its debt to GDP ratio. So this is the debt ratio. The debt ratio is usually due to overspending relative to revenues. So this is the first logical step that they're saying. They're saying that the debt ratio is due to overspending relative to how much money you're getting in. And if we look at the way in which budgets are presented to us, it's presented in terms of revenue expenditure, and then you have the fiscal balance, right? And then you see how much you have to borrow. So this kind of thinking is very inherent in the way we think about government budgets. They say the debt ratio leads to market confidence in government's debt. It can either, if the debt ratio is low, more confidence; if the debt ratio is high, less confidence. The level of market confidence determines the interest rate that government faces, or if it can borrow at all. So once people are confident in government, they'll lend more or they'll lend at cheaper rates. The level where high debt and high interest rates make debt unsustainable is known. Now, this is a really important claim because there is nowhere in any of the literature where it's clear, where it's absolutely clear that we actually know what an unsustainable debt-to-GDP ratio is. We can argue it's too high, we can argue it's too low, we can say interest rates are high or too low, but we have experiences across the world in rich countries, in poor countries, in big countries, in small countries that contradict those findings. And the macroeconomic literature on this is huge. Now, from that step then, fiscal consolidation or austerity required to deal with unsustainable debt, and that fiscal consolidation austerity brings back debt sustainability and so contributes to economic growth above all when government cuts expenditure. So now the next slide looks at questions about the logic of fiscal consolidation. The first point is that the debt to GDP ratio is not determined only by the fiscal balance. There are four things: the fiscal balance, growth, inflation, and interest rates that determine that, and that growth, inflation, and interest rates are as important as the fiscal balance for the size of government's debt ratio over time. Country experience shows that slower growth or higher interest rates can raise the debt ratio where existing debt is high. Slow growth or high interest may raise the ratio faster than even very large fiscal surpluses can reduce it, or fast economic growth and low interest rates may lead to large declines in the ratio without government running surpluses. So the first step in the logic is that of fiscal consolidation is that it's problematic to focus just on the fiscal balance when talking about the debt-to-GDP ratio and what affects it. The next step is that market confidence is not the only determinant of interest rates to government. Interest rates are not an objective calculation by markets of government's fiscal position. What we know and what the behavioral economics and psychology of markets shows that psychology and sentiment affect outcomes in speculative markets. If you look at countries like Spain and Ireland, Spain has increased their debt-to-GDP ratio since the global financial crisis. Ireland has decreased it, and both are currently paying 1%. Currently, we've seen markets that Greece is paying less for government debt than the U.S. government. So the issue of what effects interest rates to government in markets is not only down to confidence. And then there's no agreement in the economics literature of when government debt is too high. Empirical studies show that very high debt does not negatively impact GDP growth. So the possible channels discussed in the literature for fiscal expansion is not only immediately going to borrow and getting into debt. The first one, and probably the one that we all think about immediately, is reallocating public expenditures. We should consider the efficiency and composition of expenditure. The next that we can consider is increasing tax revenues and also improving the collection of tax revenues. The one that's very important, and yesterday there was a report in the press by a presentation that a member of the FIC made about how high illicit financial flows are from South Africa, and the number mentioned was, I think, between 15 and 25 billion. Eliminating illicit financial flows and base erosion and profit shifting from the economy, I think, is another important way in which you can create a channel for fiscal expansion. Managing debt by borrowing or restructuring existing debt is one. So you can think about borrowing more or restructuring, and that's going to depend on what interest rates are, what the terms are, what you're going to use the money for, etc. Adopting a more accommodative macroeconomic framework, and there's, as I said earlier on, there's a lot of interest and agreement now that we need to have more alignment between monetary policy and fiscal policy, and in fact there's pressure around the world on central banks to keep interest rates low. And in fact, as I said, we're seeing very low and in the bond markets negative interest rates, which are basically being used to drive economic growth. And also this means that if government does take on more debt, that they pay lower interest rates if the central bank keeps rates. So expanding social security coverage and contributing revenues for social protection is another way. Now, in terms of how do we mitigate the cost of fiscal consolidation, revenue and expenditure consolidation measures have direct impacts on economic growth, service delivery, and welfare. It's imperative to ensure that negative effects of consolidation measures are minimized. The 2020 MTF guidelines propose expenditure reductions. However, to date, consolidation's focus has been on the level of expenditure, and insufficient attention has been to the composition and quality of spending. Efficiencies cannot be achieved through maintaining existing service delivery models with slowing budget growth. There's a need to ensure adequate implementation and monitoring of plans and programs, and service delivery models should be reviewed and low priorities should be downscaled to create budget space for high priorities. So basically it's saying that if we do decide to cut expenditure, we can't have it a kind of as a shotgun approach. It needs to be targeted, and we need to look at the composition and quality of spending within that. Now, the next section is going to look at South Africa and where growth will come from. I'm going to run through this because I see I've already taken about half an hour of time. A low-growth macroeconomic environment is likely to severely constrain the effectiveness of microeconomic interventions. Global growth is likely to remain poor. Therefore, consideration should be given to the impact of continued fiscal consolidation on the economy. Declining government expenditures associated with lower GDP and may have a reverse multiplier effect on the economy. Fiscal expansion and well-targeted expenditure opens the possibility for increased household consumption and investment to drive economic growth. This graph shows the different parts from the demand side, the components of GDP as a percentage of GDP. Now, we see that household consumption and private fixed investment will probably remain subdued. The fiscal consolidation may very well continue to have a downward effect on economic activity. Therefore, enhanced multiplier benefits may exist when increasing government consumption expenditure or increasing public sector investment and employment growth. The top chart basically shows the shares as a percentage of GDP. We see that household expenditure has been around about 60% of GDP for a long time. The general government consumption and total fixed investment as a share of GDP have been around 20%, and the last line is the net exports minus imports, and that has sort of hovered in the low numbers below 5 over the last period. The chart below shows that since 2010, basically, annual percentage change in most of these in real 2010 prices have declined. Just to reemphasize, so we're seeing households being 60%, household expenditure being, consumption being 60% of GDP. What we have seen is that household debt to disposable income rose a lot before the global financial crisis. Basically, there was a lot of debt-driven consumption as it became easier to access credit and increased financial flows from abroad flowed into the economy and increased liquidity in the South African economy. And households have actually worked quite hard to bring down household debt to GDP. However, if you look at the smaller gray bar below, it shows debt service cost to disposable income. And we see that basically from 2011 or so, that this hasn't changed. So even though the debt to disposable income of households has come down, because there's been a change in composition, especially from mortgage debt to unsecured debt, credit card debt, those kinds of things, households are still paying the same amount on debt service, and so they still, their consumption is still constrained. And so we can't expect, I think, for the at least for this medium term and even longer, a large boost to consumption, to GDP from increased household consumption. And if you look at the black bar that's very small, we see that from 2006, household savings have actually been negative. If you look at credit extended to the private businesses and fixed investment, the red line basically shows total credit extended to the private sector, this is businesses and households. We see before the crisis it increases a lot from 2003 to 2008, it's over 20%. During that period, private business enterprise investment, gross fixed capital formation, increased by probably around 4% from 2003 to 2008. So a lot of that money, that debt extended to the private sector, went to debt-driven consumption and also speculation in real estate markets and financial assets, and didn't go into fixed investment. If we look at the period after the crisis, let's say from 2009 onwards, the level of credit extended to private businesses and fixed investment is basically about 10% higher than the pre-boom times, the early 2000s, right, of the before the global financial crisis. But the level of private business investment is more or less at that same level. And so what we're seeing is that credit extension has increased by about 10% to the private sector, but it's not accompanied by investment. And so that extra lending is not going into investment in South Africa. And that fits in with the story that I think the UNCTAD is telling about the global economy, is that at this point the private sector is not that interested in long-term productive fixed investment. They're looking at short-term high returns in financial markets or other places. So this graph shows basically the different components of total fixed investment, public sector, public corporations, general government, and private business enterprises. And we see that since the end of the crisis, that the private business enterprise fixed investment has returned back to the early 2000s, and the actual increases that we're seeing in and relatively small and declining since 2016 or so, increases in investment have been coming from especially the public corporations, and to some extent this has been unfortunately investments in things like Medupi and Kusile. We saw general government, we saw investments in World Cup soccer stadiums, etc., and basically the increases after 2010 coming from the general government and public sector, not the private sector. Now, I'm going to, in two slides, I'm going to end and then hand over back to my colleague Nelia. Just in terms of the actual performance and outlook in South Africa, this graph basically shows estimates from different sources the South African Reserve Bank, the Bureau for Economic Research, the Reuters Median, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and now they've revised South Africa's GDP growth outlook for 2019-2021. The first line of the table shows what is, the estimate was by National Treasury, and we see that all the revised estimates are much lower. So Reserve Bank is 0.6, Bureau of Economic Research for 2019 is 0.2, etc. So I think this graph is fairly self-explanatory. I won't go and talk about it anymore. In terms of real GDP growth, we put the National Treasury's budget review line, which is the red dot is the 2019-20 and 2021-22 estimates from the budget review. And then we basically develop our own estimates based on a median of Reuters collection of what different organizations predict, and we come up with the green line, and we see that in real GDP outlook is lower across the different years. And in terms of nominal growth, it's the same. So I won't take up any more of your time. Thank you very much. I'm going to pass on to back to Lilian now.
Thank you. I'll just take you through the current expenditure for the first 5 months. And this table is taken from the Section 32 reports that we receive from Treasury on a monthly and quarterly basis. So I just want to show you three main changes that has been made. So the green line shows the allocation or the transfer that has been made to the NOL and SAA. It was 3.8 billion. You will see it in the first 5 months. I've added a line for SABC, but the money has not flown to the SABC because they only requested those funds now. The last green line that I just want to highlight is that Treasury already factored in a saving of 4.8 billion. That saving is in terms of one of the mitigating factors in terms of the for efficiency gains for expenditure. That 4.8 is in terms of in terms of the early retirements that they're going to offer. For this year, they estimate that we're going to save 4.8 billion, and over the medium term in 2021, they estimate that we're going to save 7.5, and in the outer year, they estimate that we're going to save 8 billion just in terms of offering early retirement for older people in government. I also want to talk with this slide. I'm just also going to talk to slide 45 and 46. Other mitigating factors that Treasury has implemented was in terms of to limit overtime bonus payments as well as progression payments. They also indicated that they're going to try and save money in terms of looking at the system of staffing diplomats missions. They should look at that model, and that will be revised. That will be in slide 46. Some of the other mitigating factors or efficiency gains that they're trying to implement is to try and change the macro structure of government. I've got a summary in slide 46 of the macro structure. Some of the things that have been votes that has been changed was mineral resources and energy were merged, sport and recreation were merged with arts and culture, and then new government communication and information system. There was a new vote created, and some of the vote names were changed. So initially we thought there were big changes made to the macro structure, but it seems at this stage that we only gained or reduced the structure by one vote. So in the MCPPS, we will also make sure that we do those checks and see which departments, which names has has changed and which departments have merged. But at this stage, we only gained one department after the macro structure has been changed.
Thank you, colleagues. Good morning, honourable members, Chairperson. We do apologize by keep on flipping forward and backward. We just had to juggle the slides a little bit this morning because one of our colleagues could not come in. So we had to divide the slides again. I'll just continue from the slides from revenue. My name is Dumisani Janjis. I'm one of the deputy directors in Parliamentary Budget Office in Finance. I'll use my... Thank you. All right. So I'll keep on juggling it as well. We do apologize. Okay, I'll start from here. Slide number 32. We really do apologize for that. Some 32, just before or just after this one, which will be 31, obviously. I do apologize for that. Right, thank you. So what we show in there is the 5 months collection of the revenue as at the 31st of August. Just to show indication how far has revenue has been collected in major revenue strands. But I think also comparing it to the prior year, say what was the scenario in a similar situation in 2018, and you could see largely that we're a bit below the last year's collections around this time, by less than a percent. But when you look at specific revenue instruments, they've got PIT, which is personal income tax, VAT, and you'll see those are some of the bigger ones that have collected lesser compared to last year. Because on average, PIT last year was 38.8% 5 months of the year, and this year it's 37.6%. So clearly, there are already indications that we are not doing as we're doing last year, which could lead to, you'll see now in our projections that there will certainly be under collection in the current year. Already there are signs already in this regard. Well, I'll talk to revenue more detail a bit later as well. So the next slide, which largely it's a slide that what we have done as PBO, we have used the historical collection and a profile of monthly collection of revenue to re-estimate how much, also take into account the first 5 months of the year's collection to estimate how much are we able to collect as revenue at the end of the year compared to the budget estimate. And our indications are that most of the, if not all of the revenue instruments will under-collect revenue based on what was the budget estimate and leading to 48.9 billion, we estimate that would be the under collections at the end of the current financial year. And of course, that will affect the main budget balance, as shows there that as a result of under collection and higher expenditure as well compared to what was estimated or was budgeted for at the beginning of the year, we see that also by 21 billion, which leads to a worse off main budget balance compared to what has been estimated in the budget review in February. So we're looking at 321 as opposed to 255, which is more or so 66 billion. That also just to indicate at this stage that there will be bigger budget deficit and bigger under collection of revenue in this regard. And clearly, the downward revised revenue and nominal GDP projections translating to larger deficit over the MTF, as you say. And I think in this graph, what we're doing, we're just showing the effect of that would have on the over the MTF of
lower collection and lower than expected growth, and the main budget balance looking worse than what has been estimated. That table just shows how will that affect the main budget balance over the MTF. No. Yes, I think, of course, Siddharth was just emphasizing that, of course, that does not take into account any policy changes that will be announced either tomorrow or next February in the budget over the MTF, which might make the picture a bit different, of course, there. Of course, with the larger budget deficit over the MTF translating to higher debt to GDP growth over the MTF, and this table also shows that that will be higher debt to GDP as a result of the higher budget balance over the MTF, based on our estimation in the fiscal framework there. We also wanted to give a status in terms of how far we are in terms of our government guarantees, which of course shows government exposure as well as in terms of how much government is exposed on different government guarantees. We have major ones, the state-owned entities. We've got also IPPs, these are some of the big ones. And you've seen the change has been quite increasing on all of those, with Eskom being the big one, and I think we've seen that. And the picture might have changed for the first month of the year, as we have had some discussions in Parliament, in the appropriations committees, in terms of Eskom having to get more debt from the markets and so on, and obviously that would mean more exposure, because the guarantee largely just simply means if an entity borrows money from our side, they use government as a collateral, or in a simple term to say, if the entity doesn't pay back the money, we will back it up and make sure that we pay the back money. So that exposure was showing that it's been increased over time in that regard. Coming back to the revenue discussion, can I just give you this one? Use this one. Of course, there won't be any major tax or revenue proposals in the MTPS. But we thought that we should also provide a background to members, as we have shown that we expect some revision, downward revision, some of the revenue instruments. But I thought, let's give members, finance committees, a background on some of the issues and what has been the trend over the years on revenue collections, and some of the key issues which we thought going forward to the MTBS, considering some of the proposals, members should have that at the back of their mind. So I think that's what I'm trying to do with these slides there as well. 90%, more than 90% of government revenue comes from the taxes. That's a big issue. More than 90% of our revenue as government, national government, comes from the taxes. And that, in a way, is an indication that if anything, if the profits are low, or if the low employment, or people are not consuming more products or services, that will likely affect the outcome of the revenue thereof. And of that 90%, 80% of it's make up of the personal income tax, which accounts for almost 30%, 8% of it, and value-added tax accounts for 25% of that amount, of that 80%, and corporate income tax accounts for another portion of it. And I think also what I'm trying to emphasize here is that, it's very important to understand that the revenue largely dependent on these factors. Level of employment, will mean higher taxes. If the employment goes down, might lead to lower taxes and so on. And profitabilities in the corporate taxpayers, the lower they are, the lower the corporate tax income is expected to be collected. And hence, also even the consumptions, the more we purchase goods and services, the more government is able to generate more VAT in this regard. But also, as Siddharth was saying earlier on, we've seen over the years that there has been also factors of abuse of the tax system and manipulation of it, which also has affected the way government raises tax revenue over time. I mean, the bars there, the table, the bars there, I don't know if it's a figure or whatever, graph, it just shows some of the big contributors into tax revenue and how have they fared over the five-year period. Of course, there are narrative around it, what happened to the other ones and so on. So obviously, we can provide that in this regard. But also, what we've seen, you know, coming back to the issue of my earlier indication on the under-collections, we also wanted to also emphasize that when you look at the outcomes of 2019 and 2018-19, you realize that there has been that indication of under-collection against the revised estimates, and also a quite bigger indication of under-collection when compared to the main budget estimates in February of 4.3% thereof. And you know, the point, as we emphasize, that the role of economic activities does affect the level of at which the revenue is collected was raised in the by government thereof. So, you know, the more the economy grow or the better jobs and so on, the better the performance of the revenue collection in this regard. But also because, you know, the budget was announced in February and at a new parliament starting in June, we thought we should also update the members in terms of what some of the major revenue proposals that we announced and how do they fare in terms of how, which are the factors or which are the major instruments that will be contributing to that. 15 billion was announced as additional revenue to raise in the current year and is made up of 13.8 billion being expected to be raised from PAT, personal income tax, and 1.3 billion from fuel levy and the excise duty as well. But I think looking at last year's VAT increase announcement, there was some discussion in terms of how much further concessions would be taken into account to make the increase not affect certain households more than others. And as a result, there were some concessions that government gave on VAT, which has led to for revenue foregone in that regard. So that's why, you know, the VAT is negative there. And I think the point that the previous slide on revised fiscal framework does show that there are already indications that we will miss our revenue targets for the coming for this current financial year. And I think we should expect some announcements and downward revision in the medium-term budget policy tomorrow. Zooming down to personal income, to some of the, I mean, I said here 13 billion of the additional revenue comes from the PIT, and we thought we just zoom down as well to show who are some of the main contributors into personal income tax revenue. So that table largely just shows different categories or different brackets of different taxpayers and their contribution towards the revenue as a whole there. And there's three colors there. There's green, red, and blue. And I think, you know, the green shows that before the initial measures being announced and after that, they have actually been better off compared to the red ones, which are going to be contributing quite a bigger chunk of the expected revenue to be raised from the personal income tax thereof. So you can see the red ones, the four middle ones, are the ones who contribute quite bigger compared to the blue ones who are not contributing, because they are before tax before the new measures is still the same as the taxes revenue after the measures were introduced thereof. So you see that the red, the middle bar is the one that contributes quite significantly in terms of the tax measures thereof. And I think it accounts for almost 40% of the taxpayers, the middle bar as well. But coming back to the overestimation, I think what we have seen is we wanted to highlight that there has been a very long trend of overestimation of revenue over the years. And I think we want to highlight this, that when, you know, Parliament take into account or consider some of the proposals, take that into account, how has the revenue performed over the five, over the years. I mean, the last time we had a positive outcome was in 2013, 14, as we have seen over over the years, or meaning collection being low, so lower than what has been budgeted at the budget time. And I think it brings, you know, us to some of the key issues that we also thought take them into account in considering and discussion around revenue. As we emphasize, show that government revenue, tax revenue has underperformed over the years. Underperformed over the past 5 years. Underperformed, you know, has done poorly compared to budget estimates. And I think the indications are there already that even the current year we'll see our revenue underperforming, the outcomes becoming far worse than what would have been expected at the budget estimates. Of course, MTP is there to revise that amount, but I mean, our comparison here is that, you know, I mean, one of the points I want to emphasize also show that clearly the indication is there will be underperformance. When you look at the outcomes of 2019, the budget estimates of revenue are more than 10% than the outcome of the last year, which if that is to be realized, it means there must have been a huge shock into the system to realize such a huge outcome of the budget estimates, of the revenue estimates over the current financial year. Now, of course, I mean, show the trend is, you know, whether our revenue budget estimates, in particular the tax, have we been overly optimistic over the years, hence we have so much huge undercollection. That's a question that we want to put, which members take into account and think about it in that regard. But I think another element which also want to raise and emphasize, you know, as part of the oversight on revenue collection, is the cost to revenue collection ratio, which in a simple term just simply means how much does it cost the tax authority to collect the revenue versus the revenue collected. So that is sort of the cost of collecting and the revenue divided by the two, you get a ratio. So now if the ratio goes up, it is an indication that there's a better saving, there's more efficiency in the system to get more revenue. But if the ratio goes down, it could indicate that there is, meaning either the costs are more, getting more, and revenue is getting lesser, or the vice versa, or even both. So, I mean, the point why we're raising this is that we've seen the ratio declining over the past 5 years as well, you know, from the 0.97 to 0.84 in the past financial year. But of course, it's still within the range of the international norm, which is 1%, which is a 1, but it has been declining. And I think the question we raise is, does this mean the tax authority has been performing less effectively in collecting revenue, or has the measures that are put in place have not been effective enough to support the tax authority thereof? And also another point which has been in place for a while, the discussion in the Fifth Parliament even coming through, is the issues around the tax refunds. You know, how has that been dealt with and how far has that been addressed? I know the South Commission was at meeting the committee recently, but I think as its effect on the revenue collection, also take into account, you know, the uncollectible debts. If you lump that up as part of your estimates, it will obviously distort your outcome in a way. If you say you're going to expect this much of refunds and only find that actually beyond that it affects your collection, because that money cannot recognize as your revenue. So try to put it as a point to consider as part of the oversight thereof. I think Nelly has went through this slide. I think the last slide I wanted to also touch on was on it's on provincial, yes, provincial expenditure. There we have one slide, but I think what we're trying to do with the slide, you know, we've been looking at some of the public finance figures at the provincial level. We didn't have a slide on revenue at the province because I think 90% of the provincial revenue is comes from the fiscal, you know, it comes from the equity of shares, so, and only 10% of it. And I think when you look at on aggregate, provinces are doing well in terms of collecting their own revenues, even though it's a small amount. They're doing quite well. But coming back to expenditure, you realize on aggregate, comparing it with the last year, this is just comparing the first 5 months of the financial year against the first 5 months of the financial year as well from last year to have that comparative to say how far we're doing. And on another grade, you realize that the blue, the red button, is it red or maroon? Yeah, the maroon button, the block, it's the actual expenditure for last year, 5 months into August, and the green one is this year's collection into 5 months. And on a grade, you realize it's within the same level of 40% expenditure. But also, but when you look at specific province, you see that it fluctuates a bit, but generally it's within the same range. Of course, that's lumping all the expenditure, which includes all your current expenditure, capital expenditure, and transfers in that regard. And of course, you can delve in quite detail there. I think one of the things I wanted to emphasize there, which is not obviously there, it's when you look at specific classification of expenditure. In particular, you know, generally the provinces when coming to current expenditure, it's quite been in par at such a aggregate level. But I think the bigger issue, which has been historically a trend, is around the capital expenditure. In particular, when you look at the social infrastructure spending on your education, health, and social development, there has been certainly a trend of slow spending or even a trend of underspending in those areas. So I think we thought we should highlight that to say, look, as Parliament, you know, I know they'll look at some of the provinces, but there is quite a historic history of underspending or slow spending in capital expenditure at the provincial level. I think we're done. The last slide is conclusion, which again, it takes us back to what we have been trying to say, look, you know, sent by the office. The President has, after the election State of Nation address, highlighted the importance of national development plan implementation of it and encourage and emphasize how important it is for government to implement. As we have seen in our research as well, as the office, that not much has been, you know, there are some challenges in integrating the NDP targets into departments and entities plans, and even the budget alignment is not as expected. Of course, we've got such long reports, as Nila was saying, thereof. And also, the issue of need to further or continuous monitoring and evaluation in terms of how departments are implementing or are realizing the plans as they put out in the NDP thereof. Of course, you know, Parliament would probably want to ask the government to explain what are the plans, why haven't they, what are the strategies in place to try to realize those targets are set out in the NDP. On the economic outlook, we indicating that the global growth was made worse by weak demand in an increasingly uncertain political and economic climate, widespread global adoption of fiscal consolidation and austerities in other instances has certainly contributed to poor domestic and global economic performance. But I think the point that Siraj was emphasizing there as well is that government is also concerned that even if the government has been implementing fiscal consolidation, we have not realized our fiscal objective as we set out when we had the fiscal consolidation of reducing the debt to GDP ratio to a certain level, even if we implement the fiscal consolidation, which I think government has acknowledged in many instances in this regard. Global consensus that an integrated approach for both fiscal and monetary measures to support growth and our demand-constrained economic growth continues to be below that world or even our similar countries, developing countries, rates. And of course, it raises the questions where we think growth should come from, given that the private investments and private consumption has been is likely to remain subdued. And more consumption, public consumption, the investment through fiscal expansion may be required in this regard. Fiscal consensus has been too low, it's too general without focusing on specific or quality of expenditure. That might also improve if Parliament takes into account. Of course, what are the opportunities of having fiscal consolidation that we are missing out? Of course, you know, we're also saying, co-chairs, that our estimation shows that in the current trajectory, or as we are, we like to see revenue performing quite poorly as it's been, and expenditure increasing. And obviously budget balance being worse off, and therefore leading to more higher debt-to-GDP ratio over the MTF, as shown in the table there. And also, revenue collection has not performed as it expected, largely because of the economic growth and also employment and lack of lower consumption in the economy. And we've seen that over the past 5 years, you know, it's getting worse off in terms of outcomes compared to the budget estimate, and therefore we should be concerned, or Parliament should be concerned, about our performance and the efficiency of collection of revenue in this regard. Lastly, government faces several expenditure pressures, and some has been budgeted for in the budget, and some have been budgeted for. We've seen ESCOM and special appropriations bill, and others who expect that to be appropriated in the adjustment budget. There's a need for some efficiency measures have to be taken into account. Some of the efficiency measures have been implemented or is announced in the budget, but there is a greater need for more monitoring and evaluation of the implementation. Thank you so much.
thanks, Dr. Jankis and Mr. Raj Mohammed and Nelia Holland for the briefing. The purpose was to brief us as members of parliament and legislatures on what is expected on the MTBBS. And tomorrow at 11, there's going to be a lock-up where as members of parliament will get a briefing from the minister and his officials on the MTBBS itself. Then from there, the minister will present the budget statement in the National Assembly. Then the process of public hearings will start. I will take hands, but by 12 we must be done, because there's supposed to be a meeting of the subcommittee to deal with an issue of the PPO director. As I've said, this is more of a briefing. The actual MTBBS is tomorrow, and we're still going to receive a briefing. But we thought it would be important to get an independent view of the budget overview coming from the office called the PBO. There clarity and questions. I don't expect that we get into a deep discussion on this issue. It will be clarity-seeking questions. Then we close at 12. I will take hands, starting from this side. The co-chairpersons will assist me to identify members of the NCOP, NA, and comrades, I mean colleagues from provincial legislatures. Ryder, two, George, three, Noxie, four, Walker, yes. Then provincial chairperson. And then the chairperson from the other house.
The higher house.
The higher house. And then
not the other house, the higher house.
It came with it's from Comrade Nottol. Then Shenga here. Yeah. Comrade Nigelet, do you have anything? Okay. Honorable Rido.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will be very brief. Slide 10. Bullet point 2 relates to the National Health Insurance. There's three amounts given there, and it says amounts of 75, 125, 175 million will be considered. Are those three options, or is it three separate amounts for different things? If you can just color that one in for us a little bit. Slide 31, the highlighted bit in the blue there, in green. South African Airways denial payments in terms of Section 6.1b and the SABC payment. I was under the impression these were coming out of the contingency reserve. Now, I see contingency reserve is just above the line further down the page, and it's not marked against that. If you can just clarify that. And then there's a slide that was added on the back which says other slides. And we didn't get an explanation on that. And it looks very interesting or intriguing. And I'm wondering how much information is hidden in that particular slide, because I think that that particular one might be cause me a bit of a headache personally. Thank you, Chair. And then if I can just ask for some guidance from the Chair about the processes for tomorrow, what we're allowed to take in, what we're not allowed to take in, etc. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Dr. George.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentation. It's very, very interesting, and clearly a lot of work has been done on it, so well done. On slide number 15, I just wanted clarity. On the first section, it talks about adjustments to the public sector wage bill, and then it indicates some negative societal impacts, and then at the end, privatization and strengthening PPPs, it also indicates some negativity. And then on the next page, page 16, it goes on to talk about the IMF advocating fiscal consolidation, where it then talks about reducing the public wage bill and then also revamping the model for the state-owned enterprises. It seems to me that the first section here is talking about some negativities, and the IMF is actually saying that actually this is what you should do. Or am I misunderstanding this? Because what it seems to me is you're saying, well, IMF is saying this, but we're not necessarily agreeing with it because there's another view. So I just want clarity on that, what you're actually saying there. And then on slide number 33, it was very clear, the decline in the tax revenue, obviously revenue is down, expenditure is up, so the deficit increases, but service delivery isn't improving. So to me, it seems that government spending and borrowing is crowding out service delivery, and that is gathering momentum. We've been talking about the fiscal cliff for a while. Am I wrong in my view that we've already gone over it? Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Honorable Abrams.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you so much. Chair, I'm on slide 17 on clarity. Firstly, let me really appreciate the expert advice that's coming from the budget office. It is indeed very helpful. On page 17, that slide talks to the UN support of a fiscal expansion. But there's a point there that talks to the green transition. Now, my question is whether their attitude towards carbon tax is also positive if they support the green transition. Then on page 15, I tend to imitate the presenter's chair because they start from different slides and I start from the back. You know, when you talk the adjustment to the public sector wage bill, yeah? We understand that mainly the private sector seems to play the role of investing or sponsoring into government. However, when it comes to the wage bill, couldn't there be some assistance that is provided by the private sector as well, so as to decrease the wage bill in the private sector as well? I don't know if that will assist with our economy, but I would like to solicit your views. Because for me, it's not only about just increasing the public sector bill, but it's also about
decreasing the difference between the various sectors, both in the public sector and in the private sector. And it is in the private sector where the wage for the executive is exorbitant. So I'm just putting there a question as to whether that would not assist our economy, because I see that in the same slide you have put there the people who will be affected the most, who are teachers, nurses, and the police. And in my view, those are the kinds of people who are affected right now. So if you want to take something from them, you would really be killing them. It's true that you have discovered and researched that they would be the worst affected, because they are already the worst affected. Chair, my last clarity is on the slide that Doc referred to. Oh, sure, thanks. It's the slide of the provincial fiscal updates and the spending by 31st August. Very clear what we see there in terms of the actual expenditure. And I just wanted to be certain, because the red stands for 2018-19, the green stands for 1920. But for me, there is no indication as to what is good, what is bad, because if we're not comparing financial years, I would understand maybe red stands for the danger zone. But having put the performances as they are, how should we perceive them in terms of how good is this that we see in front of us? How bad it is it? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable. Honourable Arun Motswana from Northwest Chairperson Finance and Coxter.
No, thanks, Chair. I think you saw the wrong end, the ends of the fact. Honourable member. Thanks, but.
It's not you. Oh, okay. No, sorry.
Yes, Rana from the
Yes, thank you, Chairperson.
Yes,
Honorable Viluana.
Correct, yes. On slide 10, it's also clarity on the HR capacitation grant. My question would be, what are the specific targeted skills that would have been referred to in terms of this HR fund? The second one would be on slide 42. On slide 42, the 10% that has has shot up against the 2018-19 estimates. What informed that, or what could be the issues that have led to that 10% shoot, so to speak?
Honorable Luana, and then who is the chairperson from the other house? Honorable Karim.
I would like to thank the chairperson of the other house for allowing me to speak. although he's marginalized me, you can see where I am. If indeed you can see. No, but Comrade Chairs, I want to raise something that people are changing procedure. For 25 years, the ANC used to sit on this side of the benches and the opposition on that side. Now I see the ANC is mainly on that side, which I think is a good thing. We're a multi-party democracy. But I just want to say this change was made without any discussion anywhere, and it shows the rebelliousness and recklessness of the younger generation. So anyway, having said that, I want to say I really think that the section on macroeconomic review and fiscal policy, it's like entering very interesting terrain. In fact, this is one of the most stimulating inputs we've got, I think, from the PBO for a very long time. I don't know why Nicola is nodding her head, because she's only been here 2 years. And we've been here since 2014 receiving. I really think it's very interesting. Do I take it that the team understands, and it's their every right to do so, that what they're saying is going against the trend that National Treasury is going for? And that's what they should do, Chairperson's colleagues. They must give their own independent opinion. Ultimately, a decision-making is ours. But I think they're doing very good work. They're breaking the sort of limits of their own work up till now, which has been a bit too sedate in my view. So I want to welcome that. I just think it's unfortunate that we rushed through it. I know it's been long, but the section on macroeconomic overview, economic forecasts, on fiscal policy, on the relationship with fiscal and monetary policy, on the relationship in fiscal consolidation and growth, those are very, very big issues, you know. And I really think we need a separate session on that sometime, Chairpersons. We must discuss this. I mean, that in itself is a discussion of its own. Not now, you know, leading up to maybe early January or something. I don't know. Oh, late January when we get here, early February. Because those are decisions that we can't just take off the hoof here. But they provide a framework for the independent assessment of the four committees, we Parliament, of the positions that National Treasury and Government take. So I really think that's very interesting. I would like to suggest there may be a need sooner or later, or maybe even next time they come here, to tell us a bit more of how they want integrated fiscal and monetary policy in South Africa, on the relationship between fiscal consolidation and lowering debt to GDP ratio. I mean, that's a very interesting area. I don't know where Treasury is and if they're here, but it'll raise the hackles and who cares? I mean, this is Parliament, right? But I'm just saying that this is very much against what the National Treasury would hold to, and we are free to entertain those positions if we agree to them as a majority. I also would like to raise two process matters very quickly. There are observations I could make, but there's no point. Yeah, there's no discussion space here. There isn't the time. We have to leave it to others for the reasons that the chairperson explained. But there are two process issues that I think we must be a bit more keen to respond to. One is, if I understand it, I don't know if Frank is here or Esther or Zakele or Antonio or somebody here could tell us. If I remember correctly, when we amended the Money Bills Act last year, we said that this thing of having two completely separate reports, see, we look at the chairs, the new chairs in particular, we look at the revised fiscal framework for this year, and we also look at the fiscal framework for the next 3 years. Then we do two separate reports, and we have two separate debates, and we say exactly the same things. Most of the time, not even relevant to the report, right? So many of us argued it's a meaningless thing. Maybe it'll work in Switzerland, right? What's the relevance of it here? Right? And so we tweaked it, and maybe we'll be guided by that, because I think the committees have the right to take a decision, whether they can do two separate reports or whether it's going to be one report with two separate sections. The reason I say this, chairpersons and colleagues who are new in particular, when people make submissions here, they don't make a separate submission on the revised fiscal framework for this financial year and the projected fiscal framework. It will be foolhardy to expect even the Swiss to do it. So how much more in an emerging democracy like us can we do it, right? So what I'm saying is, it seems to me reasonable, if the law allows it, if I think I'm correct, that we look at what comes out, and instead of doing two separate reports, we actually do one report, because we do an overview of the submissions, right? And then the recommendations on the revised fiscal framework will take up one section, and the next section will be the recommendations on the projected three-year fiscal framework. So it's one report. What we've been doing is very stupid, Chairperson. You know what we've been doing? Because the DA has been, well, one particular person in the DA, frankly, the others didn't agree with him. He says, no, no, that's the law, we have to do it. So we used to do the same report, exactly the same report twice. The only thing, the recommendation section changed, but we did the same overview to please that one person. Now the law has changed, and that person mercifully is not here, inflicting damage wherever he is now. But the fact is, he was the only person really, even in that party, that felt so strongly about it. So we must get some advice from the lawyers in the first instance about this matter, not immediately, but they must look at it. The second point, we have a problem. We passed this law and we repeatedly conflate roles, right? And I think that must stop. So, for example, we want to ask the researchers and content advisors and the committee, secretaries in particular, to look at the submissions that come, Chairpersons. Because what often happens is the public doesn't understand the distinction between the Appropriations Committee and the Finance Committee. So you will get, for example, a wonderful submission that came from the Early Childhood Center, remember? A brilliant submission on the importance of the first, 100 days. If a child, the first 6 months or something, you're finished. You can never compare to a child who's come from an upper-class background if you come from the underclasses, unless you're exceptional. There are those exceptional cases. And they were so brilliant. But the unfortunate thing was they were submitting it to the Finance Committee. We have no say on how much of money goes to the Early Childhood Center. So we asked them to go to the Appropriations Committee. So they lost a whole year because they had to go to the... We write to the Appropriations Committee and say, we refer this matter to you. But because the Appropriations Committee is so busy, and because they haven't had the same submission, it got delayed by a year. So can we plead with the staff, when you get submissions to the fiscal framework, check that they're not dealing solely with issues of how much of money goes where, and then say, no, it doesn't fall into this public hearings, it falls into joint appropriations public hearings. Can we plead on that one too? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Honorable Karim, and the institutional memory that you have and the recommendations, and they will be seriously considered so that we all agree on the process. And with that experience, it will be quite helpful so that we don't get into a process that is going to be fruitless, but get into a process that will assist all of us, both here in Parliament and in the provincial legislatures. So the staff is here. They will assist in and see if we can't reconcile our programs through the joint committee. Sheng, Honorable Peters.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, and obviously very thought provoking. And Chair, let me just agree with Comrade Yunis that there are many macroeconomic issues which have been raised, and with the best of intentions, we can't do justice to them here. Yeah. That's one. And secondly, it's unfortunate that perhaps they don't need to appear. But it would be interesting to hear, again, the high echelons of National Treasury, what their argument would be. The chair from the other house knows my position on some of these things. Yeah, knows where I stand on some of these things. Perhaps just a little bit of clarification. The cost of revenue correction. What is it? Is it revenue over cost or cost over revenue? It's cost over revenue.
Okay.
That's one. And perhaps if consumption, which we agree on the aggregate demand constitute about 60% or more of the aggregate demand function, and the rest, your investment, your government, and your net exports, it's 40%, and then the investment is means even less than 40%. Why are we so preoccupied by investment when its contribution to aggregate demand is compared to consumption? It's what it is. Well, I've got many other questions. I said that we can't do justice to the topic, but if you could just deal with that, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Shink.
Chairperson, I want to make a request before PBO respond to these issues. I want to request Advocate Jenkins to talk to the House rules of the lockup, because I think that question came from Honorable Ryder as the first speaker, and it will only assist because the majority of the members are new, they've never been exposed to the lockup. They must know, in as far as security, what is it that you are allowed to bring in, what is it that you are not allowed to bring in, what is expected of you in the lockup, and once you are in, you are in. So, Advocate Jenkins, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and good morning, Honourable members and colleagues. The lockup and the rules around it is a little bit fluid, but the main purpose of the lockup is that there is no communication of the privileged information that you received in the lockup, which is the MTBPS, the various bills that are going to be tabled. So what we do not want to see, given that the lockup, is communication, tweeting, social media, disclosing the information. While the lockup is taking place, there is a media briefing by the minister about the information or some of the information that might be disclosed at 2 o'clock when the MTBPS is tabled and the minister delivers his speech. So the idea of the lockup, ma'am, is for members to receive the information and to start preparing to engage with the information, especially the next day. So while there's allowance for political parties to bring in one or two support services, support staff, to assist them with analyzing the information that's given, that has been allowed. A member won't be refused entry if they want to bring in their electronic devices, but it's really an issue of how far can one then allow communication and about what? I mean, from where I'm sitting, ma'am, if there's an emergency at home or something, you can't prevent the member from communicating around that. But where to draw the line is really up to members themselves not to communicate what is in there, taking photographs of the information given to them and then publishing that prior to the MTBPS being delivered. It will be definitely a type of contempt of parliament if one does that. And it will just bring the whole process into disrepute. So we've never had really much trouble with it, with information flowing out. There's one or two, but that's the whole purpose of the lockup, ma'am. So if members can keep that in mind and form those collegial bonds across party lines while this is happening, that's the whole idea, ma'am. Ma'am, if I may just raise two things, and while my mic is on, if that's okay. I mean, the first thing is what Honourable Karim has asked about the reports on the MTBPS fiscal side and the revised fiscal framework and the adjustments budget is 100% correct. There can be one report consolidating those two areas. That flows from the money bill amendments that we've made. And ma'am, just on the presentation of the PBO, if I may and if I'm allowed to, I would just like to throw a question that the committee might want to consider asking National Treasury, and that's around the efficiencies of tax collection, because I see that is a concern. And all the projections were down except the dividend withholding tax. That went up compared to the others, and that might be or might not be due to efficiencies, or it might or might not be due to economic activity, that there were more dividends paid out and therefore more tax collected than expected, which would be strange, seeing that the economy contracted a little bit, and if there's more dividends, one would assume there's more profitability. But I'm just going to leave it there, ma'am. It's maybe something that one can look at, given that there's under collection and that there might be constraints within National Treasury, and maybe there's a turnaround strategy that the committee needs to engage with. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, Advocate Jenkins. Honorable Masha.
Okay. Honorable members, lock-up is lock-up. We get in at 11. We go out with those documents when the ring bells for the House and go straight to the House, the NA. For members of the upper house and members from the provincial legislature, we will go to the gallery as guests. We will be allowed to be in the gallery. But members of the NA, the lower house, will go with the minister there. I'm saying this on a lighter note. There's no upper and bigger and smaller. The houses are equal. Eh? They make parliament together. We might get into trouble with our jokes. So that's what I want to make clear. Once you get documents, you can't go out with those documents. And please, let's try to be disciplined and not invite trouble unnecessarily, because the police will be there. Thank you. Security services.
Thanks, Honorable Matango. Honorable Karim.
Yeah, since I was attacking a certain DA leader, I should say that he approached us, and I thought it was very sensible, to say, look, can they bring staff from the party political divides? Because they often the media approaches the parties, and usually, even as a party leader, it's the member of the finance committee who guides the party leader on what to say. So we said, yes, each party can bring up to two researchers. Secondly, he also approached us to say, can they please use a computer instead of handwriting? And it seemed to us, and we did discuss it, in this ICT age, it's fine. Provided, this was the understanding Treasury gave us, nobody releases a statement before the minister has delivered his speech. And we must plead with people. The point the Chairperson Maslango is making is very important. National Treasury wasn't very keen that we bring in computers. And we said, okay, we'll disconnect it from the Wi-Fi. But so far, except on one occasion, and it's not clear it happened amongst the MPs, might have been in media, at about 1:45, or so if I remember the story, I can check, somebody released details about it. There's no time to spend now because we're running out of time. But it is a serious offense to tweet or say anything about those issues because of how it can impact on the market. So if in fact it happens, Treasury has every right to say you cannot enter with any computer or any electronic device, and we'll have no right of recourse as Parliament. Because that's the way it is all over the world. You don't release the statistics. I mean, something like the chairperson, but Lizzie can explain more as well about the impact it could have. So please, we sign a form. And I want to congratulate the person who took the initiative. I've been battling for 2 years to make it for 11 o'clock. Because when we started at 10, by the time we got to 12:30, people were getting irritated and walking up and down and so on. So we tried to put it to 11. But we didn't quite get it. So whoever did this thing, congratulate them. Because 11 to 150 is a lot of time. Thanks very much.
I'll just quickly give clarity on slide 10, Honourable Ryder. The amounts, 75, 125, it's for 2019-20, 2020-21 is over the medium term. And then there was another question on the human resource capacitation grant will be used to appoint staff. That also some clarity that we
see. They are too soft. Speak closer to the mic.
Okay.
It's meant for that.
Okay. I'll try. And then the human resource capacitation grant, there's still a lot of clarity that needs to will come out during the hearings as well as during this whole period, because I also have a question on the appointment of staff. Is it appointment of staff to establish the fund, or is it really appointment of the contractors that's going to provide the service? That's not clear in the NHI bill at this stage, because this is coming from that bill exactly as is. And we can also share, we did a brief on the bill, as I said. We did a summary of a summary just to make it clearer and more readable that we can share with the committee members. And then the other question on the extra slide, Honourable Ryder, we've been fighting amongst each other how many slides we can present today, because there's such a lot of things they can share and we want to discuss and want to share with members. So some of the slides just didn't make it, but I think that little diagram is in the brief that we can share with you and explaining what we mean. But it's almost like a summary of a whole section in the NHI bill, the diagram. Yes, and I think the other one was on slide 44, on some of the efficiency measures that Treasury implemented already in terms of offering early packages. That was one of the measures they implemented, and they're estimating already what they're going to save in terms of that. And in the first year, they're going to save $4.8 billion. And in terms of spending against the contingency reserve, in the Section 32 report, it's against that item in terms of the Section 6 of the appropriations bill. It's currently there because during the adjustments budget, they also use the contingency for other allocations, not just for the SOE.
Thank you. I'll answer the questions related to the more macroeconomic slides and the questions on fiscal consolidation. On the point that Honourable Curry made, I agree that there should be a separate discussion, and that we're very happy to prepare for that discussion whenever the committees are ready for that, and to talk about macro policy. And we've done quite a bit of work, and we've kept track of the literature and different economic views on this. So I think we are well prepared to lead such a discussion, and also we'd be happy to hear National Treasury's perspectives on that as well, and maybe respond to some of their views or their views on our views. On Honourable George's questions or comments, the slide 15 is sort of it's almost like a summary of work that has been done by institutions like the International Labour Organization and others to show the main, and I've basically chosen from that extensive literature some of the main areas where fiscal consolidation has actually been implemented. And you can see from what the IMF is saying for South Africa that it actually fits in with those kinds of things, and we show that it's been broadly and widely accepted. And so, because often when we talk about fiscal consolidation, it seems to be quite an abstract notion, rather than saying these are the channels by which they get implemented, and they get implemented through things like saying, well, let's look at adjustments to the public sector wage bill, and most of these things we need to take on a case by case basis, because and also within countries, within different parts of government and different levels of government. Because there may be some areas where it actually really is justified to adjust the wage bill sharply downwards. There may be others where it's not. What I've done is from the literature here in slide 15 is to basically draw out and say these are the overall implications, and a lot of these implications have had negative impacts and affected service delivery. It raises the issue of a trade-off. And we talk about how do you, in a later slide, we talk about dealing with the implications of fiscal consolidation. And we say that, you know, this kind of broad-based approach to just say everybody should reduce their budgets by 5, 6, 7% over the next 3 years is too broad, and that it actually should look at specifics and what kind of consolidation and where and the impacts of that. And so... And the same applies for privatization and strengthening of PPPs, because that is one of the common measures used in a fiscal consolidation package. And the outcomes have been fairly consistent, and we've even seen World Bank literature saying that in the past they have supported increasing privatization and PPPs, but they actually now taking a step back because they've actually seen negative consequences. And some of the negative social impacts we mentioned are also mentioned not only by organizations like UNCTAD or the ILO, but also by the World Bank, to say you could end up with very high cost of guaranteed revenues. You could end up with certain private monopolies instead of state monopolies in certain areas. So that's what we've tried to do with that slide, is to give a sort of a broad global picture, also to move away from South African exceptionalism. Because we always think that we're different, but we actually, what's happening in South Africa is very common around the world. And a lot of the responses and the literature that we're seeing, and especially the reports from like the World Economic Outlook from the IMF or the UN reports that cover multi-countries, raise some of these issues really well. And we'd be happy if we do a bigger presentation on this to the committees to bring in their views. And so the question about, you know, but the IMF is saying this and shouldn't we be doing this, we contrasted the views of the IMF with what UN agencies are saying. And we basically said that, you know, there's an assumption within the IMF perspective, that fiscal consolidation and sectoral reform will improve private sector confidence and stimulate investment. And what I did with the slides on where will growth come from, and also in the points that I make that repeats what the UN agencies say, is that in the current global economy outlook and what's been happening within South Africa, that perhaps we may be...
Siraj?
Yes, sir.
I know you've got a passion on this.
Okay.
But we don't have time now.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The subcommittee has to meet, and yes, members, sir, as you can see, are filing out because they've got
okay.
others.
Should I
so
just
if you can,
then?
Just
okay,
round
so
up.
Okay, so...
In a minute.
Yeah. Okay, so that's... So we do give the different perspectives, and I think as you can see from our slides, we sort of do come down more in favor of the UN than the IMF in this approach. The question on fiscal cliff, and are we already there? You know, South Africa seems to be the only country at the moment in the world, even amongst very high debt emerging and developed countries, that's talking about this. And also, we seem to be the only country in the world where people are sort of, politicians and senior government officials are voicing concern about fiscal crisis. And I think it's really something that people within government should be wary of, because it sends a certain signal, but also it doesn't necessarily reflect, I think, the situation. One is, if you look at, for instance, Britain, I mean, Britain's debt-to-GDP ratio is 90%. They've been willing to go through this whole 3 years of Brexit pain, and Johnson's administration has now come out and said, we will do what we need to get the economy to recover after, which basically means they're willing to take on much more debt. So the question of how much debt you can take on and how much extra spending you do depends, I think, very much on your situation and what you're willing to do with that. And there's nothing, I think, in the literature across left or right-wing perspective that points to that we actually, at a debt-to-GDP level, that's really dangerous and a fiscal cliff. And I've had these discussions with people who actually come to present in Parliament in the public hearings about the fiscal cliff and the fiscal cliff study group. We agree to differ on these issues. But in my view, we haven't reached a fiscal cliff. And from the literature, it's actually not clear where that point is. And I think, again, it's on a case-by-case basis we need to assess that. I think maybe that's where I should stop, Chair, and let my colleague finish.
Thank you, Chair. I think I won't go in because of time. There was just one question on the 10%. I think what we're showing there, Honourable Mohan, sorry, I didn't get your name, but from Eastern Cape. I think we're just showing that the budget estimates for this year is higher than 10% higher than the last year's outcome. I think that's the point, which obviously does not necessarily mean, you know, it took into account the outcomes for this year when the estimate. So I think the point we're trying to raise there is to say, what does it mean? Does it mean there should be so measures put in place to actually push the outcome so higher to get 10% out produce more than the current outcome? That's what you're saying. Thank you. Well, of course, the government's estimates, they take into account different factors. As you said, largely it's economic performance, you know, and individual instrument as well. There are mechanisms within individual tax instruments which determines how much would be estimated as an outcome. And of course, that the point there is that not necessarily mean it has taken into account the outcomes of the current year. But even still, when the proposals were made was in February, and the outcomes came out in April. I mean, later in the middle of the year. Thank you. Sorry, Chair, can I just raise one point? We'd just like to emphasize to the committee that we'll be doing our presentation next week, Tuesday, and if members have any specific issues or matters they want us to look into for next presentation, of course, we'll be taking into account the MTPS itself. Please do send those questions through to the committee secretaries, and they'll send it through to us so that when we do our presentation for next week, we take into account those specific issues we want us to address. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, presenters, Dr. Jankis, Raj Mohammed, Nelia Holland, the entire staff of PBO, for the well-informed presentation and the effort that you have put in the preparation for this presentation. It was quite informative. Thanks very much. Let me also thank my colleagues, Honorable Buteles, Chairperson, Appropriations, National Assembly, Honorable Karim, Chairperson, Finance, NCOP, and Appropriations, Chairperson, NCOP, Honorable Matang. Thank colleagues from NA, NCOP, and colleagues from provinces. Thank officials from Parliament and officials from National Treasury and officials from provinces. Thanks very much for being here and the preparations for this briefing. So, announcements, the lockup will be tomorrow, E249. E249 is second floor in the National Assembly building. It's the building this side. We'll meet there at 11. And then the subcommittee chaired by Honorable Buteles will be meeting after the adjournment of this meeting. I don't think there's any other announcement. Honorable members, officials, the meeting is adjourned. Thanks very much.